Colonel Manreal, too. Were there any other impressions of the American troops at Tego?
Well, they came and looked at us. They didn't seem to be very busy, those who came and looked at us. They couldn't understand why we were putting up a bit of barbed wire and digging ourselves in and so on. They thought we were extraordinary. And they came, and they were quite certain that we had lots of whiskey and that we were going to give it to them. And they didn't realize we had nothing at all. Perhaps I should say here and now that the Times correspondent who had been killed, the first one, the second one, who wrote a book about it, in his book, and I've got an extract here, he said that he was bored by the British, they were dull, and so he went and joined the Americans. And that's why the Times got all its news of what we were doing via the Americans, which meant that I've never bought the Times paper ever since, because it was telling lies, but not produced directly from us by our own British correspondent. We were dull, businesslike and dull, and the Americans were wandering around and making the most of a thoroughly bad situation.
You said that the Americans were surprised at what you were doing, but could you tell what...
Well, we were... Sorry?
What other reaction they had toward you?
Well, when the fighting started, they came along and said, where are the British? You're worth a division to us. I wish I was a British officer. Your soldiers, they deserve medals. The two colonels came along one day, and they'd been shot at by one man on a hill. And along came my ration truck with a couple of fellows inside it, and they stopped their truck, saw these American colonels in the ditch, and they said, oh, that's all right. And they went up with their rifles and sorted out this chap and came back. And the American colonels came to me and said, they wanted these two chaps to have a medal. I said, that's they were doing a normal day's work. And that was the position. They just didn't understand. I mean, later on, when the withdrawal took place, it'll come later, I expect, but we were in the paddy field having marched back. They always went in vehicles. We didn't have any. And we'd marched back several, I don't know how many miles, and pretty tired, and they got back in the early hours of the morning. And we were told an hour or two later to turn around and march back to where we came from, because in order to help an American division which was in trouble. And at that moment, we were about to march out of this paddy field, and the Argylls are one side of the awful track, we were the other. And the regimental sergeant major of the Argylls told me afterwards that down the track came an American vehicle. On the front was written in chalk, Pusan, which is the base port. So that not only were they going in the wrong direction, but they made quite sure we all knew where they were going, which was fairly typical. The driver got out, the officer sitting beside the driver got out of his vehicle and walked up to my, or rushed up to my policeman in the road, who was trying to clear the road so we could march out in the ordinary way that we do it in our army. And this chap said, you can't hold me up, I'm an officer, etc., etc. And my soldier knocked him down. The regimental sergeant major of the Argylls was so delighted that he turned his back and, of course, didn't see it. I heard their story afterwards, and that's very, very typical of they just weren't soldiers.
You've talked about digging in. Can you tell me about the defensive position which you set up?
Well, we had a defensive... Well, I mean, it's just like we all do things rather the same way all the time, we being properly trained. And we had our headquarters. It was dug in with an all-round defence. We had one or two little... we had our RAP, our first aid post, regimental aid post, in a rather miserable little mud hut. And the companies had their areas, and they were dug in just the same way. And that was everywhere ready for anything that was going to happen.
What about supporting artillery?
Well, we never had any. We had nothing. We went to the brigade headquarters, a troop of anti-tank guns, which were never used against the tanks. They were used to block roads in the advance up to the Yalu River to keep the Americans from coming, from disobeying orders and driving in front of us, rather than the way that they used to do in the way back when they were consolidating their position against the Indians in America. But that was we blocked the roads with our guns. Now, as far as I know, they were never used against tanks, not in my time anyway. But we had this brigade headquarters, an anti-tank troop, my battalion, the senior, the Argylls, the junior, and as I told you, how they were composed. And we had an ordnance detachment who we never saw. They looked after stores down in Pusan. And that was all. We had nothing else. We didn't have any vehicles initially. Our vehicles joined us some weeks after we'd arrived. we relied upon the Americans for everything. They fed us, they gave us what they could, and the drivers of their vehicles, who were black, they did give us drivers as the campaign progressed for some particular purpose, but we could only get the drivers to stay put. My sergeant major was one up the spout, and I said, "Now, these chaps have got to stay here. You can make jolly sure they do." And that was the only way we could get them to stay there, otherwise they'd have driven off. We were with an army which was utterly, utterly inefficient. And as I said, I think in fairness to the Americans, they weren't very proud of their troops there, because they weren't sent there to be troops. They were sent there to do guard duties and generally keep things sweet and quiet, the war being over.
Did you see any other Allied forces, such as the South Koreans?
Well, the South Koreans, of course, were trained by the Americans. There were quite a lot of them. The Americans had put their faith in these people. They trained them. And they got American officers, and they were dressed in American kit. And as Americans compose, as we all know, and Americans are composed of all the nations of the world pretty well, who have become Americans, you very often couldn't tell an American from a South Korean, because they, American with a Japanese background or Chinese background, looked just the same as a South Korean. They were wearing the same uniforms. But of course, they weren't as efficient as they would like to be. And of course, with the American forces being what they were, they had to bear the brunt of everything, and things didn't go well with them any more than they did go well with the Americans.
What was your impression of the caliber of the South Koreans?
Well, I didn't come across them very much, really. I mean, I don't think I'm in a position to say very much. They didn't. They were there, but I wasn't. We weren't very impressed with them, but they were there. Better somebody there than nobody.
I think a book by someone called Julian Tunstall is very familiar to you. And in his book, he makes various allegations about atrocities which were committed by Syngman Rhee's people in Korea. Did you ever come across that type of thing?
Well, Tunstall was a product of a public school in Norfolk. I've forgotten his name. And a public school boy, and he was in my intelligence section. He arrived after I'd left, so he and I did not serve together. So I can't speak with any knowledge about what his experiences of Korea were. Not my experiences, because I'd gone before he arrived, before he joined the battalion. I've got his book. I've given it by somebody, and he's a leftist, of course, and he's very biased. And it's extraordinary how facts can be twisted by one person can see a fact as one thing, and somebody else sees a fact as another. In his book, he certainly talked about atrocities by the South Koreans, and he's absolutely right. The South Koreans were told at the time, and I have no reason to disbelieve it, the South Koreans were a cruel lot, and they were the guards in the Japanese camps in the Second World War, because they were put there because they were sadists, and they were the ones who brassed up our prisoners and others under their control. When we got to Seoul, there were a lot of Koreans being rounded up by the Korean bosses who come in with us, and they were treating them extremely badly. And one or two times when British troops, not mine, but British troops were involved in sorting out their tormentors. They were shooting them, and then altogether it was not. They weren't then what you and I would call a civilized nation in that respect. Perhaps times have changed now.
What form did this torment take?
Hangings, shootings, and beatings, and that sort of thing, of people who they thought deserved it.
But did you personally witness anything?
No. I didn't personally come across it. When you're going at the speed we went, you haven't asked me what happened in the campaign yet, but when you went at the speed that we went, we didn't spend one night in the same place for God knows how many days. Well, you don't. All you see is what you see. You haven't got time to swan around. The people who swan around and see things are people who are in brigade reserve and that sort of thing. We've got nothing much else to do. They can see what's happening around them, particularly if they're in a centre like Seoul, a town.
Did you at any stage in your career get to know Julian Tunstall?
Well, no, because he joined the battalion after I left. I read his book, that's all. I got it here.
Were there any other troops in the Pusan perimeter apart from the British, Americans and South Koreans?
No, we were the first. When we arrived, the South Africans had produced an air force, and they were helping us with airplanes, and they were supporting the American airplanes. There was the only troops, the first troops to support the Americans, the United Nations force, as you know, Mr. Truman had arranged this United Nations force, and the Americans had the job of controlling it and all the rest of it. And we British were the first to arrive. We were followed by the 3rd Battalion, the Royal Australian Regiment, who came and joined us in around about a month after we'd arrived. And then after them came an Indian field ambulance. And after them came the 16th New Zealand Field Regiment. And then after that, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. But they all came at varying times. The Canadians arrived in early 51. So they were arriving all the time, and by which time we became the 27th British Commonwealth Brigade. We started off in the small way, as I've described, and we finished up as the 27th British Commonwealth Brigade with our own guns, New Zealanders, our own field ambulance, Indians, our three battalions, four battalions, Canadians, Australians, Argylls, and the Middlesex.
Now, coming back to Taegu, when you were setting up the defensive line, could you actually see the enemy from where you were?
No, nothing at all to see at all. I arranged a patrol to go and see what was happening over the other side of the river. And this patrol, we'd found there were one or two people the other side, but nobody fired at us. Nobody was difficult. The Argylls who were on our left, I think they had some Korean soldiers, North Koreans, who arrived one day to see what was happening. They had a small engagement, but apart from that, it was all peace and quiet. But it was an ominous peace. There were people about north of the river, but they weren't making themselves known to us.
How soon was it before the fighting actually started?
Well, suddenly, we were in the middle of September, about the 18th, 19th September, we had the brigadiers gave us orders to, vehicles were produced and gave us orders to assemble on the east bank of the one that goes through Taegu. My battalion was ordered to cross this river by a rickety bridge. It wasn't a bridge at all, really. It was a few planks, and you could just, with a bit of luck, get across one man at a time, and with what I could carry, and make my way along a valley with hills either side, to support beleaguered American scout troops. Scout had one or two tanks and armored cars, who were in a hamlet. And my orders were to cross over as soon as possible, and I managed to get over before 4 o'clock in the evening, and we marched along. We hadn't got anything other than what we could carry. We passed an American tank, which we knocked on the door to see what was happening. That was all we passed. And then we got to this hamlet, and we found this collection of Americans. They were all in this complete huddle. I mean, everybody was touching everybody else. They were obviously not very unhappy. And they were on the hills around them. They were obviously where North Koreans, because there'd been a certain amount of firing. And so we joined this rather terrified lot. And next morning, my orders were to capture this, what we later called Middlesex Hill, which is towering above us to the north. And I laid on my plan of action, and it started off at 7. Yeah, there's an account of this being written up, so I don't think you want to tell me. You want me to tell you again? It's all in writing. And we captured this hill. The Americans were supposed to support me with tanks, but I couldn't get that. My platoon commander went off with his platoon, and the tanks couldn't go with him. It was a credible business. Anyway, he captured the small hill, which was necessary first. We called it Plum Pudding Hill, this young man, and did it very successfully. And then we leapfrogged the companies up and finished up on top of our hill. And there we drove off. We had some casualties. We drove off the defenders. And, of course, it was the first time that anybody on the United Nations side had climbed a hill. The Americans never left the roads or their vehicles if they could help it. So very quickly we learnt this the hard way, because they started to shell us. And the only people who had the shells were the Americans. And I had the greatest difficulty in discovering who was doing it. And I was told that there were gooks on top of it. Gooks was the name the Americans gave to the North Koreans. There were gooks on the hill, and they were shooting them off. And I had some difficulty explaining that there was no longer gooks, it was British soldiers. And would they kindly stop? Meanwhile, the Argylls had been told to capture the hill, the other side of the valley. And when they got on top of that hill, the American planes napalmed. They were napalmed by them, and Major Muir, the second in command, said neither the gooks nor the Yanks will get us off this hill. But of course, in his BC, which he was posthumously awarded, the part about the Yanks was conveniently left out. But it was the Yanks who shot him up and shot him and killed, had produced the casualties. And those of my battalion who were available went to help them out. And from that moment, the Argylls and the Middlesex became allied regiments. We honorary members of each other's messes, which is rather a delightful privilege. English and Scottish regiments don't often have that sort of link. That's all been written up, and I don't think you want me to talk about it now, because my memory is not as good as what has been as it was when I wrote it up.
Were the gooks the North Koreans? Or North Koreans generally?
North Koreans were called gooks.
But not the South Koreans?
No, it's North Koreans. South Koreans were our allies. It was a general term for, in Palestine, the Arab rebels were called Uzulbarts. But troops always have a way of producing names for the enemy. and the Germans were called the Krauts. And here the North Koreans were called the Gooks.
What did you think of the military caliber of the North Korean enemy?
Well, they were in their own country. They knew how to use their rifles. They knew how to be difficult, sniping and so on, and how to attack and go disappear again if they wanted to, and they were good at that. But of course they were pretty frightened of doing anything in numbers by day, because the Americans' airplanes were all over the place. But the American airplanes moved so fast with their napalm bombs that they very often, we thought, didn't know what they were doing with their bombs. I mean, they might just as well be bombing a nice friendly village as the foreign soldiers. The casualties amongst the civilians were quite awful from these napalm bombs. I mean, I've seen terrible, all the skin burnt off, and it's quite awful, living skeletons. Of course, by this, after we'd captured our the hills, and our Argylls had captured this one, we found that we weren't doing a sideshow. We were actually an attack from the North Koreans. They had a dumps in the place Sonju, I think it was called, in the town beyond. There were dumps of ammunition and so forth, and obviously that was the basis for their next attack, and we got in first. So we made quite a name for ourselves quite quickly, we British, on that occasion. That got around, because nobody had been doing much in that line. They'd been going backwards rather fast until then.
What did you think about the use of napalm, both from the military and from other points of view?
Well, napalm bomb, we had in the Second World War, we had flame-throwing tanks. And these were all part of the setup, and you had these flame-throwing tanks, and as we know, they were part of the attack, and troops were with them, and it was a very useful way of getting troops out of the enemy, out of woods and copses and out of trenches. And that was used. The napalm bomb was an equally unpleasant thing, a fire thing, and burnt you. But it was dropped from the air. Well, if you've got to be, whereas the tank could see the enemy and flame, when it used its flamethrowers and knew where they were, the Americans didn't necessarily know where the enemy were, and their planes went at an enormous speed. There's nothing slow about the way they moved in the air, and therefore they'd have to be pretty good and pretty quick to know what they were dropping their bombs on. And I venture to think that a lot of their targets weren't targets at all. They were civilians.
What about Allied troops? Did you see any of them?
Well, the Allied, yes, I've told you about how we were the first. The Turks arrived, the French arrived, the Belgians arrived, the Dutch arrived, and I mentioned the Indians. The Turks, in their first, they were told to go and capture a village, and they did it, and they killed everybody in the village, which is the Turkish way of doing things, always has been. And then the Americans who were supposed to be with them didn't come up to the Turkish expectations, and a very large number of the Turkish contingent turned up in my battalion. They said they were fed up with the Americans, they wanted to join the British. So that answers your question.
But did you see any Allied troops hit by napalm?
No. No. I never saw any Allied troops to speak of. You see, you're talking as though we were at the beginning of this war. You're talking now, what, a year or two later, your question will be answered by somebody sitting, different person sitting in my chair. But we started off, and we were going up at great speed up to the Yalu River, and then we came back with great speed when the Chinese came in. And unless you didn't come across these other people very much, they were, until later on when the lines consolidated, the line was consolidated after I'd gone, and then all these troops were Commonwealth Division and all the rest of it. That's later on. Now, what I'm talking to you about is the very early days of this campaign, which is a very different story from the year or two later.
Now, can you tell me what happened next in the narrative after the capture of this Plum Pudding Hill?
Well, after we captured the Plum Pudding Hill, it was the main hill, Middlesex Hill, we called it, the big one. And then the battalion was, I can't remember exactly what happened, but the battalion was ordered back to Taegu and was taken up by air to Kimpo, which is near Incheon. At which place, as history will tell you, General MacArthur had laid on Marines and a landing. And the Marines had gone in a big way at Incheon. There wasn't much opposition. But as a result of that, they got in behind the Koreans, these North Koreans, and the town of Seoul, the capital, fell. And from that moment, of course, there was desultory fighting and so on, but the great thing was, the Americans' great thing was to get on to the Yalu River at the first top speed. And everybody got in their vehicles and the tally-ho, and off they went. And if they were told, if the order of battle, the order of movement was British first and or then an American division, that didn't suit them at all. So they would break all the rules. They weren't interested in orders, and they'd get in front of us if they could. And as I told you earlier, we had to use our anti-tank guns to block the side roads such as they were to keep the Americans from disobeying their orders and coming in first. When the Americans were leading, every now and again a sniper would start up from a hill, and if we were following behind, you see the whole American battalion in front of you, or regiment in front of you, halted. And they all had their vehicles were all numbered, and you started up, and if you walked up the line, as I have done, the last vehicle would be 40, the next one would be 39, and then you finish up with number one, the commanding officer, behind numbers 10 to 15 or something. And there they all be, waiting for airplanes to come along. They whistle them up to shoot up the odd sniper on the hill. And without that, there was very little idea of attacking with your forward platoons and the way we would have done. They just sat and waited for the airplanes. And so a lot of time was wasted on these occasions, and the odd sniper did his stuff quite nobly because he wasn't properly dealt with by the forward troops. But anyway, it was a mad rush. We never spent a night, more than one night, in any one place. And we got into Seoul, and we went on, and I got a map here which shows you the various...
You were just saying about the terrain.
Well, the Korea is a terrible country to fight a war in. It's like the northwest frontier, although with no let up. There were no roads; they were all tracks. We went over. There were these fast torrents. In the summer, they were water. There was a certain amount of water, and the winter, of course, they were torrents. The tracks just went over them. There were no bridges, and you drove over these streams. It was a sniper's paradise. From Taegu as the crow flies to the furthest point we got, which was a place called Taechon, and that was about, 20-30 miles from the river Yalu, which was the border with Manchuria and China. From there to Taegu was, as a crow flies, about 320 miles or thereabouts. But I suppose in order to go from A to B, and if you weren't flying, you did more like 450 to 500 miles, I think, because that everything went round, nothing was straight about the roads in that country. Pyongyang, where there was a mad rush to get into Pyongyang, we were told to try and get in, and we had to. The Americans were trying to get in first because they thought that was a good thing to do. Well, there's no harm in that. But we had a crossing over a river, a tidal river, which was rather an interesting experience. We managed to get over it, but it took us a long time. The bridge had been blown up outside Pyongyang, and so everybody was trying to get by without getting over this bridge, over this big river. Eventually, the bridge was repaired. And as I said, we got up to this, up to Taichung, and there it was very unpleasant because there was a nasty smell about the village we found ourselves in. One felt that there was, it was pretty ominous. It's more, when you've been fighting a war, you get a pretty good smell of what's happening. And we had reconnaissance people out, and they came upon a dead Chinaman, and we hadn't seen a Chinaman before, and he was beautifully turned out. He had a lovely pair of fur-lined boots, which my drum major promptly purloined for his own use. And he had a lovely hat and very nice clean uniform, and he was dead on this hillside. So that told us that there was some Chinese around. He certainly wasn't a North Korean. The elders in the village sat and looked at us with their beards and their funny little black hats they wore. And we felt this is not a nice place to be. And then some Americans went up the road, the dusty road, and you saw where they'd been with their vehicles, and they turned round. They didn't like the thought, didn't like the idea of getting any further. And we'd been told to recoup there, and we were all pretty dirty. We hadn't had a bath or a proper wash for years, and our B echelon turned up with some spare kit and things, and we were just settling down to get a bit poshed up, and then we got orders to withdraw, because the Chinese had definitely been seen to be coming in, and the stories were that they were coming in hordes on white horses and heaven knows what, and the word went round, and the Americans were just as keen to go as they hadn't been hitherto to go forward.